gives me very great pleasure to welcome you to this lecture this afternoon on European monetary policy in the past, at present, and if I may say so, greatly daring, in the future. And we could have, I think, few better to talk to us on that topic than Professor Dr. Helmut Schlesinger. He was president of Europe's leading central bank, the Deutsche Bundesbank, during a difficult and disturbed period for monetary policy between the reunification of Germany and 1993. Prior to that, he had been a long-standing servant of the Bundesbank as economist, senior official, and member of the directorium. He personifies, more than anyone else, the virtues that have made the Bundesbank an honoured and emulated in the form of absolute probity and a steely resolve to maintain the benefits of low inflation and a sound currency for his people. For many years before he became president, many observers saw his advice and guidance as playing a central role in charting the Bundesbank's strategic course. Dr. Schlesinger was indeed himself in the hot seat during the difficult years which saw the speculative attacks on the European Exchange Rate Mechanism, the ERM, which some commentators blamed on German policies. He needed all his virtues, including those of long-suffering patience, to stand up steadfast in the face of the verbal battering to which he was sometimes subjected, not least at the time by a certain British politician. He's always stood his corner with the support of clear and thorough analysis, total probity, and calm conviction. Now that he's retired, we welcome the opportunity to hear his reflections on European monetary policy, past, present, and future, and perhaps certain British politicians. He has said that he will answer questions directly related to his lecture afterwards, but not, for example, on current issues of German monetary policy or what the pound might be trading tomorrow. As chairman, I'll try and help sort the questions out appropriately. But now, let me welcome Dr. Schlesinger.
Sir Director, Governor and former Governor of the Bank of England, dear Charles, students, ladies and gentlemen, it's really a great honor and pleasure for me to speak at the famous London School of Economics and Political Science and before this distinguished audience. This school, this part of the London University, has not only a long tradition of research and teaching, but also a long-standing influence on economic thinking over the globe. I am reminded to Otmar Emminger, the highly influential member of the Bundesbank and Bundesbank's decision-making bodies from 50 to 80. He was always very proud of having had a chance to be a student of this school. And his dissertation on monetary policy in Great Britain between 25 and 32, a rather interesting period at the end. This dissertation is even interesting today and has been published. During that period of the early 30s, in political and economic analysis, Europe was not considered as a unity, not even in a vague sense. International monetary and currency problems were mainly discussed between the United States, Britain, together with the Commonwealth, and the rest of the world, or the dollar, the pound, and all the others. The economic political debate of today forms a sharp contrast. Nearly every week or every day, we hear and read of the pros and cons of emerging European Union, and of the monetary and economic union in particular. with the programmatic speech of Monsieur Balladur in January this year, that France and Germany should concentrate themselves to reach a European Monetary and Economic Union in 97. The response from heads of states, finance ministers, central bank governors, and are numerous from other countries. Not as quick, not for all countries, if ever, some of these responses. Even those who have formulated and signed the Treaty of Maastricht are now explaining important passages of the treaty in different ways. I shall refer to some of these points later. But please allow me to present my views to the whole problem in Europe, step by step, the past, the present, and the future. History tells us that an economic integration of regimes leads to and also needs a monetary integration. The tendency is clear. The abolition of trade barriers between different regions, states, kingdoms, principalities, increased the wish to abolish also the transaction barriers resulting from different currencies of these regions. Germany in the 19th century can be considered as a clear example for that thesis. The integration started with bilateral commercial treaties of the smaller states with Prussia, but reached its first important results in creating the German Customs Union in 1834. And this for nearly 30 regions. This movement was succeeded by the establishing of first two coin unions in Germany, for the south and for the north. But it ended with a single currency after the creation of the Second Reich, the Bismarck Reich, then in 73-75. In a period of 40 years, a single market with a single currency had been established. The newly created political union, the Reich, a federal state, gave the last impetus for the common currency, and the dominance of one supreme state, Prussia, was the great motor behind it all. The other interesting example is the Latin currency union, created in 65, last century, between some countries of Western Europe, and the currency names of franc or franken reminds us to that episode. It was a currency system with fixed exchange rates between gold and silver coins, and therefore fixed exchange rates, so to speak, a parity grid between all these coins and currencies in that union. This system left the sovereignty of states principally untouched. It broke down for the same reason as nearly every system of fixed exchange rates has broken down until today, because the exchange rate between the real value of the two currency metals, gold and silver, changed, but the nominal value did not for a long time. Historical examples certainly cannot be applied completely to actual problems. Nevertheless, I think two lessons are important. The creation of a completely free market of goods, services, capital and labor was completed, crowned, we could say, by a single currency with a political union. One is not misled if one tries to understand the German position. A single currency for Europe needs any type of a political Überbau. Anything of a political union has also its basis here in our own history. With the end of World War II, Western Europe had to construct a new framework for economic and monetary policy. The interwar period did not give any good guidance here for the future, with perhaps one exception. This was the creation of the Bank of International Settlement in Basel in 30, which has developed as a place of interchange of information and ideas among central banks. And it is up till now, and I have the pleasure to see the governor and the former governor for that reason every month in Bâle as a member of the board of directors. Today, and with this audience, I have not to recall the different steps of economic and monetary cooperation in Europe, I mean, starting with the OECD, continued with the European Payment Union in the early 50s, and saying that the most attractive step was the creation of the European Community, 57, and predecessor, the Community for Steel and Coal in 52. From the beginning, Germany had a vivid political interest in that development. As Lord Dahrendorf, I may recall his name in this house with particular sympathy, invited by our President of the Republic, founded some ways in this context. He said very recently, I quote, "Only through Europe has post-war Germany found its way back to the world." So his quotation. The way, I mean, to the end, to that end, to be accepted among the democratic nations as one of them. This determines the German position until today, also after the unification. I may recall that both chambers of our parliament accepted the Treaty of Maastricht nearly with 100%. The second chamber with 100%. The development of the European Community during the 40 years before Maastricht, I think if we take everything, pluses and minuses together, was a success. One clear symptom is the wish of other countries to join the community, the enlargement from 6 to 12 and now to 15, and a number of new candidates on the doorstep, so to speak. My feeling is that even the development of new free trading zones outside Europe are, to a certain degree, consequences of the attractiveness of wider free trade zones as such. I mean the creation of the NAFTA, the first steps of the APEC, and similar tendencies in Latin America and southern part of Africa. As far as monetary integration in Europe is concerned, the judgment must be a little bit more differentiated. Considering the situation at the beginning of the community in 52 and 57, the progress to freely convertible currencies, to free capital movement over the border, and the installation of the monetary cooperation among the central banks was and is important. Until now, the crux of the matter is the search for the most appropriate exchange rate regime. The creation of the European Monetary System, EMS, with fixed but adjustable exchange rates was a substitution on a regional basis of the no longer existing worldwide Bretton Woods system. With the formulation of the EMS, then in 78-79, the notion to create the EQ as the center of the system can be read as a hint at the introduction of a common currency. As you know, the reality was different. It was not the artificial EQ that moved to the center of the system, but the natural currency, the D-mark assumed, had to assume the function of the number one currency in this system of fixed exchange rates of N currencies. As the Bretton Woods system has taught us, fixed exchange rates cannot be and should not be kept unchanged when the necessary convergence, especially as far as price stability is concerned, is not given over a longer period. This was also crucial in the period after 87, even and in a period in which the differences in inflation diminished but did not disappear, and the German unification aggravated the discrepancy between this strong growing domestic demand in Germany and
growing signs of a recession in some partner countries. As Jürgen von Hagen, a German economist here with an international reputation, teaching in the United States at the moment, said, I quote, the EMS constraint forced Germany's partner to rise their interest rates through a monetary squeeze. Given their, he means Germany's partner, stubborn, a terrible word which I had to read in English newspapers for a long period, considering not our partners, but ourselves. Given their stubborn refusal to realign parities, the real appreciation required prices elsewhere in the EMS to fall relative to German prices. The breakdown of the ERM occurred when governments in the other countries were no longer willing to trade elusive credibility gains from pegging the exchange rate for rising unemployment and shrinking real growth. Or, in my words, the structural weakness of every system of fixed but adjustable rates is that in the case of the need to devalue a currency, the politicians, and this is in the hands of the politicians, not of central banks, they are imprisoned, understandably, I must say, in their earlier strong declarations not to devalue. Usually, they wait not only until the last minute, but sometimes and often even longer. Then speculators have an easy game. Under the system of fixed exchange rates, for them, the danger of a loss as a consequence of their speculation is relatively small. The chances of a gain are big. At the right moment, it is a one-way speculation, and indeed, the bigger this speculation is, the more probable is the outcome. This is a simple lesson of every large so-called foreign exchange crisis in a fixed exchange rate system. And in that respect, I must say, no central bank has more experience than the Bundesbank, which since 1959 was always on the side which had to accept enormous amount of overvalued currencies against its real desire and against its internal task. The ERM of today, with the wide band of 15%, can diminish the need for those difficult decisions. It cannot avoid them totally. The convergence between a majority of member countries and the ERM is remarkable, but it is not yet given in an ideal way. Since August 1993, when we came to this widening of the band, most of these currencies deviated only relatively slightly from the parity grid, and this without any important interventions. Only during the recent turbulences in the foreign exchange markets, some countries had to increase their interest rates to support their own country, and the peseta and the escudo, as you know, had to devalue before it comes to high obligatory interventions. As I said, one of the intentions of the EMS and the ERM was to pave the way to the monetary union, the point of time in which exchange rates of the member currencies have to be fixed forever. At one time, the idea existed to narrow the old narrow band even further, stepwise. An idea which has mainly put forward by French plannings. Contrary to that concept, I believe the wider bands of today are no obstacle to take the step into stage three. It means the final stage of the European Monetary Union. Given the fact that preconditions are existing, the wide bands would make it even easier because they guarantee more realistic exchange rates and place pressure on member countries to balance their own economy through their own efforts. The Treaty of Maastricht, signed by all member countries in February 1992, it means 3 years ago, and ratified through all countries at least in November 1993, creates the European Union, in which the economic community is the most clear part, in contrary to that what is said about community foreign and defense policy. And the text of the economic and monetary union, in the narrower sense, is bringing the biggest changes for the European community and union. These are the creation of a monetary union with a European central bank and a system of central banks as the only institution for monetary policy, and later the only issuer of a single European currency. And second, the establishment of the European Monetary Institute, the forerunner of the European Central Bank, which has its seat in Frankfurt, and it works now for more than 1 year, even before the governor started to work on this task for the future. On paper, this is an important draft to reach the target of one currency for one common market. One may be reminded that this target was also the objective of the Hague Conference even in 1969, and reaffirmed by all member states, including Britain, in 72. And the so-called Werner Plan in 70 tried to formulate steps to establish economic and monetary union. And it was once more set when the Monetary Cooperation Fund was founded in 73. And then in 78, 79, the European Monetary System, and at least the governments have given the order to write the so-called Delors Report under the same intention. And by the way, always with the British vote in the Ministerial Council. Gut Ding will Weile haben, that's a German saying, which means we need some time for getting good results. Let me discuss this a little bit further, if it is a good thing and why it needs some time. The primary target of the monetary union, as well as the whole history of the economic of the European community, is a political one. My long-standing and excellent colleague, Governor Eddie George, said very recently, I quote, "Europe is about much more than economics. The inspiration that lie behind the concept of Europe after two wars, above all, is the need to ensure Europe could never be devastated by war again, as well as ensuring that Europe's legitimate interests were effectively represented at the broader international level." So far, the governor. For many political proponents of this whole development, for instance, Giscard d'Estaing and Helmut Schmidt in the 70s, or Balladur and Kohl today, they have been guided and are guided by their superior target, using the monetary union as an accelerator for the process of political unification, and using, in one way or the other, the single currency of Europe, so to speak, as a symbol, like the community flag or the community anthem. One might be inclined to find that those aspects which tend more towards emotion than rational thinking are not very convincing. But as we all know, politics are not only guided by the rationale. The question of the rationale is on the side of the economics. It is undoubtedly that a properly functioning monetary union would have a number of benefits. My list follows partly Charles Goodhart's list of those points. First, a reduction of transaction costs. I would comment that the European Commission has made a calculation saying that this is a counterpart of 0.4% of the GDP of the community. And Jürgen von Hagen, which I have quoted before, said, this is not more than 3.5 packs of cigarettes a month for a German. Yeah, I do not completely agree. My personal experience is that I had to pay nearly 20% costs for a bank transfer from France to Germany, considering the amount of 200 D-marks. I must say, this is even a point to say, well, we need a further integration. Even it is not really convincing. The second point, which Professor Goodhart mentioned, is a reduction in the risk of realignment and devaluation, and consequently, a diminishing of this risk premium in interest rates. In fact, the Netherlands and Austria have nearly no interest rate differential vis-a-vis Germany since a long time. Before the recent turbulences, the other core countries in the ERM have had money market rates which were at least not more than 1 percentage point higher than those in Germany. And the other ERM countries need more. They have to pay the price for keeping the exchange rate in the band. With one single currency, the final target of the monetary union, the risk premium of that kind would diminish. Money market rates determined by the European Central Bank would be nearly the same in all countries which are part of this union. And other benefits could be named. For instance, efficiency gains to trade and capital movement, stable or at least more stable prices in these countries which are a part of the union. And more than present, Europe could influence international arrangements in the monetary field more strongly than at the moment. Yeah, I would risk my friendship to Charles Goodhart if I would not immediately add that these benefits which he has mentioned, he has brought it later, and the disadvantages he has brought before. He was listing a number of cons, especially on the traditional costs of currency unification. He named all the microeconomic problems for central banks, banks, non-banks, following the change to a common monetary denominator. And he went into a deep analysis of macroeconomic problems, especially as far as the conflict between the end of the national sovereignty for monetary policy is concerned, but not for fiscal policy. In sum, the real economic question of a monetary union would be, does it lead to a better economic performance among the European countries, the member countries of the Union, or not? Or would it lead even to the contrary? The answer depends very clearly on the degree of economic convergence between the members of a possible monetary union. Convergence in the sense of the Maastricht Treaty means the nominal convergence, the degree of price stability, only limited fluctuations of the exchange rate, limited differences in national interest rates, relatively stable public finances. The treaty excludes the examination of the real economic convergence. It means factors like productivity, competitiveness, structure of the labor market, the structure of the social policies. In this context, the Treaty of Maastricht answers rather clearly three important questions. When a monetary union could start, which country could be a member, and what the position of countries in derogation, it means outside the union, monetary union, would be. It seems to me that the first question, the when, is leading to growing uncertainty as nearer this possibility approaches. As you know, the first term is 97, when a majority of countries fulfills the entrance criteria and the Council of the Union agrees with the Staat on the basis of a two-third majority. By 99, the Union could start even with a smaller number of countries. As I said at the beginning of my talk, the French government is pushing strongly for a start at the beginning of 97. Some other countries are much more cautious, and the British government seems, that's what I understand, to be against an early start, even if Britain is using the opting out clause. The answer, which country can enter and when, has to be given on the basis on the so-called convergence or entrance criteria, which I have mentioned before. In other words, it is at first a question of the economic analysis, which have to be prepared by the Commission in Brussels and the European Monetary Institute. The following and really decisive procedure is the judgment of the Council of Heads of States and Governments. If the entrance criteria are fulfilled, by which country, and if so, when the EMU should start. I do not want to bore you with any justified criticism on the essence and the definition of each single entrance criteria. It is the attempt to answer the important question if a country can be considered to be ripe for a monetary union or not. At present, a majority of prognoses do not give 97 any chances as the starting point of the EMU. At the moment, the inflation criteria, which is a relative one, 1.5%, not higher than the best performing countries, is fulfilled by more than one half of the member countries. Until recently, the divergence of long-term interest rates was also not great for most of the countries fulfilling the inflation criteria, and it has to do with it. On the basis of the wide band now for exchange rates in the ERM at the moment, except of Spain and Portugal after the last devaluation, all ERM countries, those in the exchange rate mechanism, fulfill that criteria. The three Benelux states, France, Germany, Denmark, and de facto Austria and Ireland, they were not forced to a devaluation in the ERM band during the last 2 years. But only two countries have fulfilled the budget criteria in 94, and the number of countries reaching this target may grow in 95 and 96 as a consequence of the expected and ongoing cyclical upturn, increases of tax revenues and decreases of some expenditures can be expected during these years. For Germany, the Bundesbank estimated in its last monthly report that in 95 the deficit of all public households will amount to around 2% of GDP, and total government debt, in which all the debt burden resulting from the unification is included, will not surpass 60% of GDP. It means the Maastricht norm. As the cyclical decline of the deficit can be expected, there is not much chance that more than a very small number of countries can fulfill the debt-GDP ratio of 60%, not to surpass it. Or, if they are surpassing, that they show clearly that, and now I have to quote, the ratio is sufficiently diminishing and approaching the reference value at a satisfactory pace. Article 104, C, number 2B. Everyone repeating this sentence would feel that this formulation gives room for interpretation. If, for instance, Ireland diminishes the debt ratio from 105% of GDP in 89 to 91.5% in 94, and an estimated ratio of 87 in 95 and 83 in 96, so the OECD report, is this a satisfactory pace of approaching the reference value of 60% or not? If I read the German interpretation of this problem, I would say the answer would be no. And if I understand the French interpretation of that article correctly, I assume the answer would be different. In the official French publication, Économie et Statistique, issued by the Institut National de Statistique et Études Économiques, one finds the following explanation. These two criteria concerning public finances, I quote, are appraised in absolute value and also by trend. The treaty does not stipulate that the convergence criteria are not respected when a state's government deficit exceeds 3% of GDP and its public debt exceeds 60% of GDP. It simply lays down that the so-called sustainability of government financial position is assumed to be respected if the member state in question is not the subject at the time of the examination of an ECOFIN Council decision concerning the existence of an excessive deficit. Yet the procedure provided by this famous Article 104 is long and contradictory, they say, and furthermore presumes that the reduction in these two ratios can be taken into account as soon as they are near the reference value. In my opinion, there should not be any doubt that only countries with stable and solid public finances should enter into the European Monetary Union. Otherwise, the primary task of the European Central Bank to keep the value of the money stable would be in danger. Under a longer-term perspective, one would not find many countries with unsolid public finances on the one hand and a stable currency on the other. The problem with these two financial criteria mentioned in the treaty and defined so exactly is that under a number of realistic circumstances, they are not consistent with each other. This depends on the magnitude of the growth of GDP, the magnitude of the deficit, and the magnitude of the outstanding stock of government debt. I refer only one simple case given by Peter Cannon in his writings, EMU after Maastricht, and he will give a number of those cases in his new book, which may be published very shortly. He says, if the growth of GDP in nominal terms would be, let us say, 6%, but the deficit 3%, and the debt ratio has been at the beginning 80%, it needs about 5 years to come down to 75%. In other words, countries with high debt ratios can bring down their debt ratio only in a combination of relatively high nominal growth of GDP and very low deficits, or, and both usually is not the case together, or a very moderate growth of GDP and no deficit or even budget surpluses over a longer period of time. Unfortunately, the given inconsistency of these two criteria in many practical cases will give much room for discussion and for more or less discretionary decisions about the verbal criteria which is in the treaty about the so-called sustainability of government financial position. Ladies and gentlemen, one could ask, why all these very detailed preconditions, complicated procedures, etc.? Who believes that statistics will give the right answer for this eminent political question? Why not make an offer to all member countries to apply to become a part of this merger of national central banks to one European central bank? Presumably, the most interested applicants would be those with weaker economies, and this would not be a good basis of an efficient merger. I come back to the German case. In the February 1990, the Federal Chancellor Helmut Kohl made an ad hoc offer to the last communist regime of the GDR to build an economic and monetary union with West Germany. And then the first democratic government of the GDR accepted it. This was a historical step, which led soon to the political unification, as you know. Economically, this was really not a merger of two closely comparable economies, and the economic and financial problems of this union and of the unification are still big. The differences among the West European economies are certainly not of that magnitude. And the problems after building a monetary union, in whatever way, will not be of the same size as in the case of the German unification. But the European case is not as urgent. Nevertheless, the German case shows us as sort of under a magnifying glass, so to speak, the economic problems of a monetary unification among countries with different preconditions. The entrance criteria of the Maastricht Treaty, the necessary proof of convergence, is an attempt at the search for an optimal currency region. That is a region in which the economic conditions allow us to exist with one currency without creating strong tensions, whatever may happen, even in the case of shocks on the supply or demand side. One could argue that there are not many countries in the world which have one currency and are really a good, an ideal, optimal currency region. One could say that there are countries in which two different currencies and floating exchange rates between them would diminish the problems of the country which exists. Completely theoretically speaking, for instance, between northern and southern Italy, or between California and the rest of the United States, a number of studies are saying something like that. Or, as I said, between West and East Germany today. There is a lot of research in the economic literature on that point. Bayumi and Eichengreen published very recently a new study about the prospects for monetary unification in various parts of the world based on criteria of the optimal currency area. As far as the countries of the European Union are concerned, they came to the conclusion that, I quote, in Northern Europe, a plausible monetary union could be formed between Belgium, Denmark, France, Germany, and the Netherlands, and later they included also Austria. Luxembourg has not been researched, but certainly it belonged to this group. I mean, this is not completely surprising. It's more or less that, what one is expecting if one speaks about the core group of countries which could start a monetary union. Presumably, with the Maastricht criteria, one could come in the near future more or less to the same result. But seven states are not a majority. Only with the state number 8 for 97, the majority would be given. Would there be a number 8? Would there be a number 9 at the end of 96? My professional experience tells me, leave the forecasting here to other people. Yeah, they are numerous, and I can keep my good record that my forecasts are not very often false, because they are very, very seldom. Ladies and gentlemen, what are my conclusions? First, I think it is high time to take the Maastricht Treaty and its timetable in earnest. The parliaments have decided. Influential politicians are behind the idea of the treaty. France is pressing. And one side aspect may be that Federal Chancellor Kohl explained that he is not prepared to act in this position as the Chancellor for more than this legislative period, which ends in the fall of 98. Either by 99 or under much less probable or improbable circumstances by 97, the core countries could form an economic and monetary union. Most of the economic problems of the change to that union have been discussed. Some problems of a political psychology and monetary psychology still exists. The name of the European currency is discussed once more. The question of a double name has arisen. The governments should not chatter on this subject. They should clear these questions. Only they can do it, not we can do it here by discussing it. Every half-backed proposal increases the uncertainty, diminishes the credibility, and undermines the whole target. In any respect, the public has to be informed not only about the problems, but also about the solutions. Nobody, for instance, could convince me that some technical problems like printing new banknotes, bookkeeping, having new balance sheets and transactions in a new currency can not be solved in a period which started in 93 until 96 or 98. Look, the two German currency reforms which we have had in 48, yeah, to the D-mark from the Reichsmark, and transferring the D-mark to the state of TDR, which is bigger than the Netherlands, for instance. Yeah, there were those technical problems of the same nature. But the main legislative and administrative work has been done in about 2 months of hard work in both cases. I know what experts can achieve if they have a clear political direction. The last question should not be avoided. What would happen if the European Monetary Union would not be realized? Politically, I think, Europe would miss an important political target. After all, it would be a setback for the idea of Europe. Economically, there would not be a big change to the present situation. For a country like Germany and other hard currency countries, even they have the strongest links among all the European countries, yeah, it would not be of a big disadvantage. Perhaps I have to pay once more a high rate there. Yeah, for changing francs into D-marks. Yeah, but for companies and banks, it's completely different. Yeah, but the countries in the south of Europe, they would be very disappointed. Even if they could not be a partner at the first step, and presumably they cannot, they hope for the future. The earlier the core countries start, the better for them to develop the necessary energy to follow later. After the events in the currency markets of the last weeks, on their side, the wish is presumably stronger than before. And even in the core countries, even in Germany, yeah, there are a number of wishes as a consequence of the real revaluation of the D-mark during these weeks. On the side of the Eurosceptics, these recent turbulences may be used as a further counter-argument. But these turbulences will come to an end, as they did always. No tempest goes on for a longer time. Certainly, the step into a monetary and economic union asks for more than only fulfilling some criteria. It asks for solidarity in the community and the necessary efforts for a community-orientated policy. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions. Yes, at the back there.
Hey, Doctor, sir, you mentioned solidarity. No doubt something will be achieved in 1999. A minimalist Western European Union of some sort. But could it be that the difficulties German finds with Western will drive Germany to the east?
Excuse me, the last sentence I have not understood.
Will the difficulties with Western Europe drive Germany to look east?
Well, as I told you here, there are a number of countries on knocking at the door. And we must be realistic that there are a number of possibilities, a number of steps in which one can help them, especially by lowering the trade barriers between the unity, the economic union and them, and on a number of other ways, transferring your capital and technology to them, as before they would be in a situation to become a member. And if I say they, it means that even these, what we are calling the Middle and Eastern European countries, are in completely different situations as far as their transformation from a communistic regime in economic life to the present one has been fulfilled. So I think the solidarity is also necessary in view of them. But this doesn't mean that we have to open them the possibilities going into a monetary union in the near future.
Yes.
Well, it leads me a little bit away from my my lecture, but I have the feeling that your notion is not quite exact, that during the recent times you may have heard something like that. Because as far as I know, when Dornbusch, Tobin and others were discussing those problems, the magnitude of international capital flows were not of these magnitude which we can see now. They have been multiplied, and to apply to such a possibility would be much more difficult. So I'm sorry, I'm not informed about that. So my argument would be that what I told you. In earlier times one could discuss it. But now I don't know how to apply it and how to apply it to cash transactions and to apply it to non-cash transactions, which are much more important.
Anybody ever voted for a new tax, I wonder? Yes. Yes, you at the back, sir.
First, I think you were referring completely correctly to the discussions which we have in our country on that subject. Yeah, and we have it since we were in the process of an integration in Europe. We have had the discussion of the so-called economists and so-called monetarists from the beginning. And this is continuing. And when I brought some of my controversies here, you see, this is the case even now. But nevertheless, if you consider the development from 52 up till today, there was a strong change as far as the real integration has been concerned, and the strengthening of the European Union. We are no more free, every country of us, as far as legislation is concerned. This is quite a different situation as that which Ludwig Erhard has had in his mind when he was very skeptical about the whole process. But in 60, 61, I don't know exactly, he made a big advertisement in newspapers only saying six plus 7 plus 4 equal 1. Well, that's what we have now. We have not 16, we have 15. And so far, he must be satisfied. And I, as having a Ludwig Erhard Prize, I would say, I changed with the development to the present situation. I think the discussion is necessary, but it would have been more necessary before the Maastricht Treaty as after.
Is there anyone at the top? No. Yes, madam. We'll have a go.
second question.
While you're thinking, can I just try and repeat the first question? The first question concerns transaction costs. I mean, the lady said that she very much agrees that 0.4%, which is the European Union estimate, must be a low one, and probably the true value is somewhere a little bit below 20%, depending on the size of the transaction. But what has never been calculated is the time that it takes to complete transactions. And what does Dr. Schlesinger feel about the true cost, taking the time as well as the apparent transaction cost into consideration? And the second question was how much time, different kind of time, how much time will it take for these good things to be brought about?
Well, I think one must be fair to the calculation of the community. And so far, and this was one aspect which they wanted to quantify. I can understand the energy of younger economists to quantify everything which they have proposed for them. But this is, as we agree, not the reality. The reality is integrated. The pros and cons have to be seen on a wider sense, and I think economically, if the preconditions are given, we can have a workable monetary union in Europe, especially among those countries which have not big differences between each other. And if this is the case, it is an advantage, and it increases further the integration in Europe and the process of bringing factors of production to the best places. I believe that even Ludwig Erhard would not be of a different opinion. Your second question was,
I mean, you used that German proverb, which can't repeat.
Well, yeah. Good thing will weiter haben. I find there are so many people in the room who understand German that I wanted to give them a chance. I think being in this process now since nearly 33 years for the core countries, not so much for the newcomers or the later comers, I think we are coming into a situation in which we can use it. And we should not be afraid. This is my point. We should not be afraid about the once for all costs, in what sense soever, changing banknotes or coins or whatever the situation may be, problems in bookkeeping and the payment systems, etc., etc. These are once for all costs. And at the end, they will be lower in this field. So that's perhaps my answer to this question.
I think just time just for one more. Yes.
Thank you. Dr. Schlesinger, in your talk you mentioned the GDP debt ratio of Ireland.
Yeah.
I understand the GDP debt ratio of Belgium is about 135%, with prospects of it decreasing by about 1 percentage point per annum over the next few years. Is this regarded as a satisfactory approach to the 60% criteria? If it isn't, while one can imagine Ireland being excluded from a monetary union on continental Europe, can one imagine Belgium being excluded as the headquarters of the European Commission?
Well, I think that's another of phrasing the problem of these 60% GDP debt ratio. As I said, it is a point for, unfortunately, for many discussions, and the prescription is not clear, and it is a little bit, it is not easy to come and to bring it through. Even I do not want to say that those who want to say we have to bring only countries into it which have a solid financial situation, that they are right. But what does it mean in fact? Does it mean in fact that Belgium has not a solid financial situation? Yeah, I leave it open, but this is a big problem.
Dr. Schlesinger, it falls to me on behalf of this enormous audience which you've attracted to thank you very much for giving us a fascinating lecture. It's always interesting to hear how other countries see questions which are such passionate and burning debates in one's own, and we have been privileged, I think, to hear this evening of very sensible, very calm, very measured view from the German economics community. A refreshing change, perhaps, from some of the overheated comments that we hear in the United Kingdom. It's also, I think, falls to me to thank on your behalf all the many students here, because I don't think I'm revealing any secrets when I tell you that it's a widely held view in the school at the moment that in the final papers that are shortly to be set, some question will probably be on European Monetary Union. So on their behalf, I thank you too.